You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Happy snow day. Great day to stay home and listen to the radio. I'm Elliot Forrest in for Leonard Lopate. It's that time of year again when we tend to look back and reevaluate the past 12 months. And what better way than in terms of the movies? The New York Film Critics Circle has come out with their 2013 winners, and I'm glad it gives us a chance to welcome back Joshua Rothkopf, senior film critic for Time Out New York and the chair of the New York Film Critics Circle, John Anderson, a contributor for the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Newsday, and America magazine, as well as Richard Corliss, chief film critic for Time magazine. Glad to have you all gentlemen here on this snowy day.
Hi,
thank you, Elliot.
Thanks for coming in. So how contentious was it this year? How is it really decided? Do you get into a big room and just sort of fight each other out to get the best picture and best director and best screenplay?
I wish that sounds like a lot of fun.
It's more passive aggressive.
there's no real deliberations in the room. We're not really sitting around talking about the merits of the film. Although this was a terrific year for movies, and there were definite groups within our membership of support for different films. I mean, it speaks well to, I think, the state of cinema in general, that we have that we had so many long votes that went ballot after ballot.
So just that I know, how many critics are we talking about make up the New York Film Critics Circle?
38 members.
And you and as you say, you do rounds of ballots until you come up with winners.
Yep.
So any surprises this year, John?
I was a little surprised that Redford won Best Actor. I know that sounds like kind of a lame observation.
For the movie, all is lost.
I thought we would have gone another way, but we did not. And although we are not Oscar predictors, we may have predicted that one. I don't know.
Richard,
the very idea of we is fascinating.
Yes, well.
Because you have 38 people, probably 32 were in the room, another six sending in proxies. And these people can hardly agree with themselves half the time. But it's not fist fights. It's like, you know, it's a quiet afternoon at Scrooge and Marley, people just filling out ballots for 5 hours. I don't think there's been a vocal argument since John Simon left the group. and so much less colorful. But it interests me how these different people form what seems like a kind of consensus. Sometimes it's sometimes passion pushes one film a little bit ahead of another. Sometimes it's a film that is slung between two films that evoke alternate passions.
Right.
And maybe Redford was one of those. Although, I mean, the reason that Redford seems more of a surprise now is that of all the film critic circles, I believe we were the only one, or one of a very few, that nominated Redford, whereas Chiwetel Ejiofor was by far the consensus winner in the other groups.
For 12 Years a Slave.
Yeah.
So as you compare to other associations, how do you normally compare this year to the L.A. Film Critics Association?
It's really not in our nature, I think, to compare ourselves to the other groups. We go as early as possible, actually, to remove ourselves from that kind of competitive discussion. We just want to deliberate on the best in the year's films, and we want to come to a decision that's sort of internal. So
I know a lot of these horse races are tough for people, too, when it comes to best. I mean, the L.A. Film Circle had chosen both Gravity and Her. The top best picture for New York film critics this year was American Hustle.
Sometimes it's timing. A lot of us saw American... I don't want to say that this affected us overly, but a lot of us saw it just before the vote, and it had a fresh impression on us, and it was a very energetic film, and it made you feel good about movies, and I think a lot of us came into the room just feeling very up about American Hustle.
Whereas Gravity, I saw at the Venice Film Festival, and most other critics saw it at Telluride or Toronto. This is August and September. Her was shown at the New York Film Festival in October. 12 Years a Slave showed in September in Toronto. So people had strong enthusiasms for those and held on to those.
Yes.
It happened that I saw American Hustle the day before we voted. I don't think I would have changed, but I was still riding the high of
of enjoying
that film.
But it's funny that you admit that. I think a lot of filmmakers know that and try to release things later in the season.
I'd like to add, though, that we saw other films just before the voting, and it had no impact on us
whatsoever.
Doesn't
help a bad film.
Yeah, there. In other words, around the time we saw American Hustle, which was very close to our vote, we also saw Wolf of Wall Street, which didn't make the same impression on us as a group. As American Hustle did.
And I saw them within days of each other, and I couldn't help but notice some similarities. It obviously might have been there for you guys as well, I guess.
In the content of the film.
Yeah.
Yeah, sure.
For sure.
Yeah.
But it didn't make your
list.
One
worked, one didn't.
for all of you, that you would all agree with that?
As a longtime admirer of Martin Scorsese, I was very disappointed that this movie, which I'm sure he meant as the... as a continuation, maybe even a climax to his films about tough guys doing bad things well, from going back to certainly Goodfellas and Casino, in a way, The Aviator with a crazed, attractive hero, seemed like a confused rehash, adding nothing and not diminishing the others, but not nearly the power. And it also concerned me that that in all his other pictures, which were about tough guys, driven by their own demons, you always saw the person who was on the receiving end of the punch. This is, if as Leonardo DiCaprio says, this is a movie about predators and victims. There's not a sense of who the people who lost all their money.
Right.
These poor pensioners, or for that matter, rich people who lost their money by investing.
Yeah, it's kind of green is the warmest color.
And also, as one difference between Scorsese's film and David Russell's American Hustle, women. I mean, they seem the same film, but one is really this crazy romantic comedy, and the other is The Wolf of Wall Street.
Yeah, I mean, with David R. Russell, he's received a lot of criticism or at least commentary that he's out Scorsese, whatever that means, or that his film is doing a Scorsese riff. But it seemed like the filmmaker who tried most to be like Martin Scorsese was Scorsese himself, and I think the effort sort of showed. The conversation about Wolf of Wall Street has been steered, I think, aside as to, does it glorify Jordan Belfort? Does it glorify Exes? But I think that's really besides the point. I don't think that was a concern of mine. It's more that it just was such a monotonous film and so ponderous and exhausting, and it's not that we don't want to go in and love a Martin Scorsese film.
Yeah. The second hour was a remake of the first hour, and then the third hour was a remake of the second hour.
I have to say, I enjoyed the film, but your word exactly, I was exhausted by the end of it.
But both films do an interesting thing; they reflect on other movies, which is something that, whether it's subconscious or not, I think we respond to.
Elliot Forrest in for Leonard Lope, talking to film critics Joshua Rothkopf, John Anderson, and Richard Corliss about the 2013 films and the New York Film Critics Circle's winners. You mentioned women. Jennifer Lawrence, I have to say, after seeing her in a number of films this year, I went on Wikipedia. She's 23. Right. I'm stunned how young she is and how she crosses these extremely dramatic roles and action films at the same time.
Yeah, she's the future of movies.
Really? What do you mean by that?
She's the great hope, I think, and I think Hollywood is going to reward her.
She has an emotional connection to the audience that's just direct. She doesn't seem like she's acting, really. She's very natural.
And her off-screen persona is really kind of wacky. And people
it's a little closer to her character in American Hustle than almost anything else she's done. There are 30-year-old, 35-year-old actresses who behave like teenagers, but Jennifer Lawrence from Winter's Bone, when she was maybe 18 or 19, that film, always seemed mature, solid. She didn't, more grown up. And yet, that's apparently acting too, because if you see her on TV shows, she's a giddy kid.
You have deemed the best director of the year Steve McQueen for 12 Years a Slave. Tell us about him and his work.
It's just that is such a mighty film, and we were really proud to honor Steve McQueen for that. It's not just a film that evokes this terrible moment in American history, but it gives us an occasion to reflect on the legacy and how it affects us now as Americans, as human beings. And I think that if there was, I think, one home run in our voting, it was probably McQueen.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for the rest of the idiots like me out there, no relation to the classic film actor, right?
No relation whatsoever.
Okay, just checking.
Or to Butterfly McQueen.
Okay, all right. Just want to make sure. You tapped Cate Blanchett this year for Best Actress. Tell us why.
She's an astounding actress, and she owns that movie. And I think I had wished that the movie around her had been better, but she salvaged it.
Playing that kind of role is I mean, that was a very tricky performance that I was blown away by the fact that half the time Jasmine is thrown off her perch and sort of like a wet cat, and the other half the time she can't get rid of this hauteur, this grandeur that she has, and the rage that Blanchett channels for that performance is it's like Jenna Rollins. It's really astounding.
I think she's a magnificent actress. To me, she is outside this part, which is, I think, is almost impossible to inhabit someone who is so self-conscious and so little self-aware, who takes an entire film to realize that she's not suited for this milieu.
Yeah, Daniel Day-Lewis is the male Cate Blanchett. I wanted to construct that, and so I wouldn't get in trouble.
And I was surprised not to see Bruce Dern or Nebraska on your list. How come?
Well, he's on my list.
Yeah, your personal list.
Yeah, I mean, again, we're all independent thinkers in the group, and we, Dern definitely played in the balloting.
There's only one. We get to choose only one. We do not publish our runners-up.
The gold or the silver and the bronze.
Or the top five. There are some film critic circles that have a nomination day and then later a voting day. We don't do that, but... Bruce Dern could well have been one of the finalists. Yeah. In fact, the director, I believe the director vote was fairly close between Steve McQueen and Alfonso Cuarón for Gravity.
And talk about Jared Leto and Dallas Buyers Club.
Well, he almost steals it away from McConaughey, and McConaughey is astounding. It's another case of the performances profoundly outshining the rest of the movie, but you don't really care because they're just so magnetic. And Leto is stumbling over it. I'm looking for an adjective.
He's really good. He's really good.
And honestly, I mean, this isn't even really a mark on his performance, but I was not expecting work like this from Jared Leto. I think that was also played into my reaction to that film, is that he... He's sort of maturing right before your eyes as an actor, and really he's really kind of consumed by this role. It's great to see. There are performers like the Cate Blanchetts and the Robert Redfords who we've watched for decades and love, but there's a separate satisfaction seeing someone who over time has had to maybe outgrow a certain perception. McConaughey is a good example of this, actually, and it sort of matures and evolves and then has this sort of great flourishing, and I think that was the case with Jared Leto this year.
Well, McConaughey has rehabilitated himself with a half dozen really impressive indie films. Yeah. Jared Leto had been out of films for 4 or 5 years at the Toronto Film Festival. He was asked why he'd been away, and he said, if I don't stay away, how will you miss me? But so he came back, and we're glad he did.
You mentioned earlier that the New York film critics don't really go out of your way to compare to other lists, but as it turns out, how much are your choices a precursor to the Oscars from year to year?
Well, Richard is the Bill James of movie awards, so he knows all
this. There have been periods from the 40s to the 60s when I think 20 out of 24 years the New York film critics' choice for best film was the Academy Awards' choice for best pictures. Recently, I can't say, and in fact, what I must say is that we do not try to predict the Academy. We don't care what the Academy does. If they agree with us, that's fine. But in the last few years, I think maybe half of our films have become the best picture choices.
It's not our intention to sort of influence the Oscars. In fact, we try to separate ourselves from that discussion by going as soon as we can.
Although I do like that sometimes we can pull something out of relative obscurity and
shine a light on something
and give them a better shot at what's...
I think The Artist a couple of years ago was an example of one that people might think, that's a lovely film, but really best? And that might have put a put a notion into the Academy. But the big question is, how is the Academy a reflector of the New York Film Critics Club?
That's right.
Exactly.
Well, we'll get them in here and we'll ask. I want to ask about some of the worst films, and we'll talk about foreign films as well. I'm speaking with three film critics, Richard Corliss from Time Magazine, Joshua Rothkopf from Time Out New York, and John Anderson, who contributes to many publications, including the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. We're talking about the best and hopefully soon the worst films of the year. And you can tell us your picks now on our show page. We'll be back with more after a break. Elliot Forrest in for Leonard Lopate on this snowy day. Joining me to talk about the 2013 movies, Joshua Rothkopf, John Anderson, and Richard Corliss. How big a disconnect do you find, or maybe you don't even really care, between what critics end up liking and what really ends up being what the people really go out and see and support with their dollars?
I think that division is sometimes played up more than it is. I mean, the job of the critic is to respond to art and write about it in an entertaining way. And so you're really serving your own opinion. You're not trying to sort of tell people what to think or what to feel. But I find that it's very dangerous to, you know, sort of underestimate the intelligence of the audience. I think that a lot of popular movies were good movies this year as well. I mean, when you talk about a film like, let's pick a big popular movie, like something like the Hunger Games sequel. That was an improvement on the first movie. That was a solid critical hit as well as a commercial hit. So, you know, I don't really think that critics live in this kind of finicky elitist world where we just, you know, pick films and the public ignores them.
But we don't have any influence. Am I simplifying? We have no influence.
Just a tad.
on the grand number of people who see movies.
Do you wish you did? I mean, I think the division I think about right away is that bad review in the Times can kill a Broadway play. Yes. I'm not sure a bad review in a paper is going to kill a movie.
It depends on the movie. I mean, we have a great amount of influence on specialty foreign art house films. If you really come out in strong support of a film without a big advertising budget, you can really help that film. You can save that film.
But so often the films that we are promoting when they released here, I mean, that we're praising, independent and foreign language films, have already gotten big exposure at either the Sundance Film Festival or at Cannes or Toronto or Venice. And so the distributors know that we, more or less collectively, are behind these films, and they give them a bigger promotion.
Yeah. And speaking of mainstream films, Furious 6 was on your top list, Richard.
Yes. So was Fast Five.
You like the series?
No, I like those two.
You like those two films?
I mean, some critics' lists seem to emphasize, which is fine, independent foreign language films, and I have many on my list. But the films that they write very favorably about that happen to be quite popular often don't make the top 10. So I have a little affirmative action slot for films that were actually very popular.
Exactly. I actually have a slot like that, too. I never want to have a list that's just of independent films or foreign films. And the film that filled that slot for me this year was The Conjuring, which was a great horror film that was released during the summer and received a lot of positive critical praise, but because I think it made so much money and was kind of a classic throwback to 70s-style horror. It's almost like there's a little disdain critics putting it on their list, but I'm happy to remember it and keep it in people's minds.
I'm guessing now as I hear you talk, I could never be a film critic because I will never go see those horror, slasher, kill-em, bloody films.
That's
I
just what my can't students say.
That
no.
one was really scary, though. Yeah.
Do you have a slot in that where it's like...
No, but I tend to have about half my list be documentaries, and I don't think they get nearly enough attention from the critics because they're preoccupied seeing a lot of studio stuff.
I don't see it on – I'm just looking at your list here. Do you have a –
Well, The Act of Killing, The Square.
Oh, you mean for the group?
For documentaries.
Yeah, we chose Sarah Polley's film,
Stories We Tell.
Stories We Tell. Oh, nonfiction film.
Yeah. Which is a – you know,
what is that?
Genre-bending quasi-documentary, which the membership saw. I mean, I think sometimes they're not exposed to a lot of the – I mean, The Act of Killing, everyone should have seen.
The membership also liked it. We Tell is also a memoir that avoids being self-aggrandizing, and it's, you know, very sophisticated.
Do you think that The Act of Killing did not – do you think that
You're asking
me. Did
not
win because not enough of the members saw it?
Yeah.
Okay.
And how do the New York film critics normally see films? Is it always in a screening? Do you get screeners at home? And does that matter that you see it either on your computer or a big screen?
My living room looks like Blockbuster came by and just dumped its inventory.
Installed everything.
Stacks and stacks of screeners. I mean, a lot of our membership is, I mean, we pride ourselves on being very well informed. And a lot of our group goes to film festivals and sees these films in their world premieres or their North American premieres. So very often we're seeing these major movies in theaters with crowds or with other critics. But yeah, we get a lot of screeners. And by the time the vote rolls around, I hope our group is as informed as possible when we make our choices.
I've seen most of the films, perhaps on my list, are films that I saw at Cannes or Venice. There's nothing like seeing a film on those huge, magnificent screens with wonderful projection. Mm-hmm. It's like what the music hall might have been in the 30s and 40s.
Do you think it informs your impression and your review, whether you see it on your iPhone or whether
you see more. You see more of the film on a screen. I've watched films on screen, and it's been a revelation after I've seen it at home on my dinky TV.
I think it's important that we see films in the... I'll put it this way. I think films have a greater impact when they're seen in the traditional way. That is to say, you're a small person in a dark room with a big screen.
With
other people. Yeah, you have no control over what happens. The phone can't ring unless there's someone behind you with a cell phone that hasn't been turned off. Then in an atmosphere where you essentially are controlling the product.
We have many listeners. One writing in, it says, this is Rosalind from Manhattan. Don't mock me, but I really enjoyed Saving Mr. Banks. Somehow this film has stayed with me. Emma Thompson's performance was lovely and vulnerable for me. No laughing, please. What'd you think?
I'm not laughing. Yeah. I actually thought that Emma Thompson did a great job in that movie. She's a riot. She's really starchy. And I think that film played for me like Julie and Julia, where you had a film that was constructed of two halves. And whenever we were in the past in Saving Mr. Banks and having the flashback scenes to her childhood, all I wanted was to be back on the Disney lot and to see Emma Thompson arguing with the songwriters. And so one half, I think, was heavier than the other half.
In my review, I was essentially arguing with myself between the rational person who hated this movie and all its works sort of so-called fact-based movies that we saw in the last part of the year weren't truly fiction, but turning P.L. Travers, already kind of a creepy woman, you know, in real life, into this starchy person whom the wonderful Walt had to thaw, was driving me nuts. And yet at the end of the movie, I was sobbing. My inner 8-year-old girl was totally taken by it.
That's
and my
sweet.
Review was an attempt to mediate the critic and the human in me.
I thought it was a movie about Walt Disney made by the Disney Company.
So. We'll leave it at that. So I'm going to stick with you, John, for a minute. We said we might talk about some of the worst films, just a couple, because if they're worse, people shouldn't go.
Yeah,
but,
I got a couple.
What'd you think?
The Secret Life of Walter Mitty, I really could have lived without and would like to never see again. And it takes a perfectly nice story, blows it into a Ben Stiller vehicle that travels all around the world for no particular point. It kind of contradicts the point of the story, which was about a guy who daydreams his life away and turns it into a movie about a guy finding his inner Sean Penn. And the product placement was shameless. It almost made me want a Papa John's pizza, but not quite.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
The 1947 Danny Kaye musical version, just 8 years after the Thurber story, did the same thing. I mean, movies...
Well,
forgive it. It's, no. I mean, in other words, you could like it or not like it, simply, but not because it's about someone who, like virtually every movie character, breaks out of his timid soul and into some preposterous adventure.
Also, it's like Ben Stiller is, even if we give the script the benefit of the doubt, he's not timid. I mean, the casting of that movie, of his own movie, I thought was slightly off. Even in Ben Stiller, the way he walks and the way he talks, the way he gestures, there's something that's so... you know, neurotic and forceful and aggressive about him. He does not fit, for me at least, the type of the sort of dreamy, timid Walter Mitty character. And, you know, maybe that's a freshening up of the concept, but it was like he had a problem connecting with his love interest until suddenly the screenwriter decided, oh, now he doesn't have a problem.
Have any of you ever seen a film, given it a bad review, and then over time maybe seen it again and changed your mind about a film?
Never.
You were right the first time.
Of course we have.
Yes, but my superego tells me not to say what it is. Yes, and over the years, I've been reviewing movies for 40 or 50 years. if I don't come back to a movie that I liked when I was a kid and say, no, that's somehow it's better, then...
you wouldn't be human. Talk a little bit about some of the foreign films from 2013 that we should know about.
Well, the foreign film that we gave our award to in the group was Blue is the Warmest Color, which is an extraordinary film. I think the conversation around that film focused a little too much on the sex scenes. But there's almost 3 hours of an amazingly nuanced relationship film around those 6 or 7 minutes of sex scenes that definitely deserves attention. That film was
and a performance.
8.5 minutes.
But who's got it? Oh, he's counted.
Here's our Bill James again.
He's watching it on his cell phone. Yeah.
what country?
That's France. A France film. And that film was that stayed with our membership. It's actually a great relationship film. And also there's the gay content in it as well, which I think kind of steers away from what the strength of the movie is.
It's probably the most romantic, volcanically romantic film that I saw this year.
It's a great way to put
it. And it might be, you know, it might be easier for us to say it's, as Lionel Trilling said about Lolita, this is a book not about sex but about love, which makes it unique in my experience of contemporary novels. We could say this is about, it's about love and not about sex. But I wonder if the two main characters had been men and we'd seen them frolicking in quite a so explicit way, if we would be able to rationalize it.
I would have found it a different experience. Yeah. one of the curious things, though, that happens at this time of the year is the Oscar race. Countries submit films. They submit one film. And this year is one in which they sort of consistently pick the wrong films. France did not pick Blue is the Warmest Color. Israel did not pick Big Bad Wolves, which is making huge waves in the foreign film circuit. The Lunchbox did not get nominated from India because they're politically motivated.
They're sending
us
the films they want us to see, not necessarily the best ones.
And in some cases, they're sending the films that they think make them look better.
Blue is the Warmest Color wasn't eligible.
It wasn't even
eligible.
Okay.
Because it opened the week after the closing. Okay. I think for Italy to choose The Great Beauty was excellent.
That's an extraordinary
But there film. Are omissions. You know, it's like, what if a Moore hadn't been nominated last year?
Right. I'm Elliot Forrest in for Leonard Lope today, talking about the year in films of 2013 with Joshua Rothkopf, John Anderson, and Richard Corliss. I see on your own personal list, Richard, not the New York Film Critics Circle, you have The Grandmaster from Hong Kong. Tell us about that.
I guess Wong Kar-wai is, we all have our addictions. I mean addictions to great filmmakers. And although when this was a film that ran 2 hours and 10 minutes when it was shown at the Berlin Film Festival and had lost 20% of its content when it was released here in the Harvey Weinstein version, and I actually refused to see it. I actually insisted on depriving myself of the pleasure of seeing whatever was left of the movie. But when I finally did, I thought it was what Wong Kar-wai does best, which is Wong Kar-wai, the Hong Kong director, which was to create a wispy, smoke-filled, carcinogenic view of romance, only to put it into a martial arts format.
And another film I think like that, maybe a personal favorite that wasn't necessarily on radars, was for me Spring Breakers. Another filmmaker like Richard has with Wong Kar-wai, Harmony Korine is someone who's who's grown leaps and bounds, and this, the content of Spring Breakers is, you know, very lurid and sexy, but this was also a moment to see Corrine really developing as just a stylist and shaping a drama. It was a really fun movie.
As long as we're talking about favorites this year,
sure.
The Square, which is Jahan Nujeim's documentary about the Egyptian Revolution, which went to Sundance in January, after which they reshot 70% of the film and then put it back in Toronto as basically a new film. And it's only right now about 4 months. The news in the film is already about 4 months old, and it's electrifying.
It seemed that Michael Moore created a popular shift in having people go to more documentaries. Is that continued, or is that dropped off in mainstream people checking out documentaries in theaters?
I think there's a lot more attention being paid to docs, yes. Moore has kind of fallen off the radar because I think he's done – his shtick has kind of wore itself out.
But those were documentaries as stand-up. I mean, not
well. They're novelty films, yeah. I mean, they're kind of novelty. And Morgan Spurlock too is another.
But very few documentary films reach the public. I think the only political documentary that did in the last few years was the Dinesh D'Souza film called 216 Obama's America,
yeah.
Where the right wing actually got to send its minions to see a political documentary.
But there were documentaries that connected with audiences this year. I think about 20 Feet from Stardom, which was a real crowd pleaser of a documentary.
About the backup singers.
Exactly. Yeah. And just galvanizing to watch that with a crowd and to hear everyone get excited about these singers.
You mentioned Harvey Weinstein a moment ago. Things are changing between the Weinsteins and Miramax. Is this good news for the film business?
Well, yeah, I don't pay attention to the. I think, well, the Weinsteins who created Miramax left Disney, which had bought Miramax about 7 years ago, and I think there might be some more bookkeeping, but they remain very. I mean,
it's a force to be reckoned with regarding marketing more than anything, I would imagine, right?
I think we could say that The King's Speech, certainly The Artist, would not have been chosen as the best picture by the Academy if Harvey Weinstein hadn't been behind it.
He's also, I mean, let's not sell him short. He's been a defender of, I think, really important films as well. I think about Fruitvale Station, which was our pick for best first film this year, and that's Weinstein. You know, yeah.
That's a great category. Do all the other film critic associations have something like that? First film?
A lot of them do.
Most of them do.
In Chicago, they have an award for most promising performer, I think. But the idea of looking forward to the future of film and singling out someone to watch, I think, is an important function of a critics group.
The Oscars don't do that, right?
No.
Yeah. And speaking of looking forward, films in 2014, what are you looking forward to?
Jeez, I have no idea. I don't know what's going on tomorrow.
To me, 2014 is Paranormal Activity, The Marked Ones, which I had to see last night, and we'll forget about tomorrow.
You take them one at a time. This has been fascinating. I hope everybody's written their lists based on the conversation here of what to see and maybe what not to see. I've been talking about the best and worst films of the year with three film critics, Richard Corliss from Time Magazine, Joshua Rothkopf from Time Out New York, and John Anderson, who contributes for The New York Times and Wall Street Journal, among others. Gentlemen, thank you so much
for
joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
This was great.